Welcome to Take Care, and thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So many of us want to make positive changes in our lives, but getting the results we want seem out of reach at times. And you say in your book that design skills are the single most important ability that we humans possess. What do you mean by that? How would design skills help us achieve our goals?
Absolutely. So, you know, this comes from decades of pursuing the question, you know, I know what I should do. I don't know why I don't do it. And this happened to my patients. This happened to, you know, leagues of people that I was designing large-scale programs for who worked for employers and those kinds of things, wellness programs at their job. And what I noticed was there was sort of the haves and the have-nots. And the have was all about the ability to iterate, which means repeating something and tweaking it and updating it, and not. And it turns out that that is very aligned with something called design thinking, which out here in Silicon Valley in California is the premise for a lot of the popular technologies that all of us use, Facebook, Twitter, even the iPhone. Those kinds of technologies have all come out of this discipline or this approach called design thinking. And so it occurred to me that, you know, that really is what's going on with individual people who are in charge of their health, that they are designing, that they're iterating, that they're approaching it like a designer. And that's, to me, the biggest difference between them and everyone else.
So design thinking is the haves. Then describe how it is that the have-nots approach it and why they fail.
Yeah, so in my work with Engaged In, we've done a lot of patient interviews and people who are facing different life circumstances, for example, caregivers of seniors or people who are, have a particular condition like diabetes. And what I started to see was the pattern with the have-nots is that they were just all over the place, disorganized, you know, didn't have a way to experiment with one thing, see if that one thing made a difference, or keep improving on it because they gave up because they felt like, oh, well, I failed at that. So it seems like the chaos and also the self-blame for it failing was the big differentiator in making the have-nots make no progress.
What are some of the questions we should be asking ourselves before we begin a self-improvement plan?
I think that the biggest thing is, what am I expecting here? You know, the process is the goal, so to speak, as opposed to the outcome. It's not that we don't have an outcome. We don't know what we want. We do know what we want. We might want to lose 10 pounds. But historically, people have approached that with, I will lose 10 pounds, and if I don't, I'm bad, or I'm a failure, or I can't do this. And instead, a person approaching it at the beginning should say, okay, I'm going to figure out how to get myself to lose 10 pounds over and over and over again until I'm there. And then once I'm there, I'm going to continue to tweak it because I'm going to get bored with how I got there. So it's this kind of evergreen process in their mind instead of this, I'm going to do this sprint and then it's done.
When you say that someone says to themselves because of failure, they say, I'm bad, that's the classic example of negative self-talk. And it's a common concept in psychology. So How does design thinking offer new insights into that experience?
Exactly. So, you know, yes, self-talk is sort of hit the masses. We all know and have experienced some form of this. And it has to do with many different sources of teachers or parents or ways in which we felt shame as children, and then we became adults and we just never got rid of it. Design thinking is freeing for that kind of self-flogging, if you will, because our expectation is placed differently. It's placed on, I'm going to continue to figure out what is going on with me, that I'm not doing what I say I want to do. And just by changing and shifting that alone, it frees us from having to fail. We're never failing. We're just redesigning the next thing for ourselves because that didn't work. And an example was my mother and I were designing a popcorn eating strategy for her prior to my wedding. And this was a vexing addiction for her. She ate popcorn every single evening. And in doing this over and over and over again, what she found liberating was that she didn't have to say, oh, I'm eating popcorn again, I'm bad. It's, oh, the thing I created to stop myself from eating this much popcorn is not working for me on some level. I need to redesign it and kind of close the paddock, if you will, close that hole in the fence so that I would be happy being inside of this environment or this little, you know, we called it a creature habitat that we were creating for her. And if she broke out of it, it meant that there was something we missed about it. And so, again, you have this sort of compassionate response towards yourself instead of this judgmental response.
In the book, you share that story about your mom, and you were reluctant to play the expert, but you suggested to her to get individual serving size baggies or bags of the popcorn. And she, this is the interesting part. I hope she doesn't mind that we're talking about her this way, but she resisted that. She said, no, look how many carbs are in each individual bag. And you were like, but mom, you're eating an entire bag. And it's so interesting that she still wanted to try to use her own willpower to limit herself, but it was the design of the portion control that eventually won. So you just see, even with the example that you gave, that there is a reluctance in us. And I was going to ask you, when you're working one-on-one with patients and clients, not your family members, but how do you get them to see what they're doing unconsciously that may sabotage their attempts at real change?
So that's really tricky, and it takes a while to figure that out because we have this gap between what we think we will do and what we actually do once we get there. And I talk in the book about sort of the relationship we have between our past self, which sets us up for the 5 a.m. jog, and our future self, which wants to stay in bed and says, no, that's a bad idea. And so, you know, there's this tension, if you will, between our predictive how I'm going to be, you know, when I choose to buy the treadmill, you know, is my future self going to follow through and do that? And or is it going to rebel or be lazy or those kinds of things? And so, again, design thinking approaches everything with a sense of compassion, a sense of empathy. And so if I'm empathetic towards my future self, I would be honest with myself, you know, I will eat that whole bag if it's in front of me, or I will not get up at 5 a.m. because I've never been a morning person. Those kinds of reality checks, if you will, and facing those and then just being okay with it is part of this whole process to be successful.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Reff.
And our guest today is Dr. Kyra Bobinet. She's the CEO of Engaged In, a behavior design firm, and she has a new book out called Well-Designed Life, 10 Lessons in Brain Science and Design Thinking for a Mindful, Healthy, and Purposeful Life. Now, you mentioned two words, empathy and compassion. There's a difference between them. And so you started to get into it, but what is it about these two emotions? What role do they play in our lives, and why are they influential in our attempts to change our own behavior?
Right. And I used to think of them as the same thing, actually, you know, as synonyms to each other. But it turns out that in the brain, empathy and compassion respond very differently and maybe using different, you know, neural networks, if you will, or compiling different signals in the brain to come up with a different result. And an example would be Richie Davidson's work at Wisconsin. They had done a comparative study where one group, Group A, received empathy training. These were health professionals who, you know, think nurses and the people who always have to take care of patients. And Group B received that plus compassion training. And so in the results, what they found was that the people who received empathy training had more difficulty looking at or receiving difficult messages or looking at images that were disturbing, like movies, versus the people who had compassion. They were able to see those horrific images, but to have compassion towards the people who were experiencing that suffering. And so the conclusion was that, you know, empathy helps you to understand what it might be like to be in a certain situation, whereas compassion allows you to look upon that difficulty, either in yourself or another person, in a longer, more sustained manner, so that you don't have this reaction of, oh, that's difficult, now I have to protect myself. It's difficult, I can't listen to it anymore, I can't watch it anymore because I can't do anything. I'm helpless. It helps you to go through that and stay with the situation no matter how difficult it might be.
So can you give us a real life example of where that might come into play with someone that's trying to design a health change, whether it's working out more, just something very specific? How would that come into play, empathy and compassion for oneself?
Mm-hmm, exactly. So I think that, you know, when people have maybe a new diagnosis, let's say somebody just was told they had diabetes, and they, let's say it's a type 2 diabetes, which often has some control, you have some control with your lifestyle, and they really, really want to change their lifestyle. They really want to eat better, they want to exercise more, all the things that they hope to do for themselves. But maybe they have a lot of addictions, a lot of social behaviors that are habits that are built into their current life, and they watch themselves as they try to change with one hand, they watch themselves on the other hand going to fast food restaurants or, you know, indulging at a barbecue or those kinds of things that kind of counter that. Well, empathy would be, I see myself doing these sabotaging behaviors despite the fact that I really want to change, and that bums me out. Compassion is, I see myself doing these damaging behaviors, and I have compassion for myself because I'm addicted to sugar or I'm addicted to whatever, you know, fried food, and I want to figure a way out of that, but the compassion itself allows me to be patient with myself and not disgusted with myself so that I can be my own designer of that behavior long term.
What I'm curious about that you haven't yet touched upon, but it is in your book, a lot of us go into these, we're going to make these changes in our lives and we are really pumped up, we're really motivated. But you say that that's the most common misconception people have about behavior change, that it's all related to motivation, that the key is motivation, that you have to be motivated. Why do you think that this is not the case?
Yeah, that's an extremely good point. There is a huge misunderstanding about motivation. It's part of, you know, sort of the casual way in which we talk about our behavior change. I just got to get more motivated. I just need more motivation. And when I fail, it's because I wasn't motivated enough or I didn't have enough willpower. And in the brain, it gives us more insight into what's really going on. For example, motivations are extremely contextual. They have a stability and an instability. So my motivation to stay alive is always on. It's always stable. It's reliable. Whenever something threatens my life, I'm always going to respond with that motivation. But my motivation to lose 10 pounds might be fleeting. It might be there one day when I step on the scale and I'm like, ugh. It might then be gone when I go to the barbecue later that day and I forget about that motivation. So to blame myself for not being motivated is damaging. And it also isn't true. It's not how the brain is working. The brain just has its attention kind of floats from one motivation to another. So what I'd rather people do is understand it in terms of, you know, okay, so I may want to lose 10 pounds, but how strong is that motivation? How strong is my emotion, which fuels my decision-making around that motivation? And be honest with myself about what is going to dominate that motivation, like the barbecue, in that moment. And that gives me clues as to how to design for it.
Dr. Bobinette, I'd like to talk to you about an example you use in the book about your addiction to a favorite chai drink as an example of how you initially denied to yourself that it was even a problem or the cause of your weight gain. And then just very quickly, if you would describe the process that you went through and then finally the end result.
That's really a good question. And I'm sitting here with my homemade chai, which is the sort of end of that story, the punchline of that story. So I did have a very cozy addiction to a very delicious form of soy chai at a very popular coffee chain. And what I went through was that, you know, I started with smaller cups, then I kind of over time migrated to the largest possible cup. And what I noticed as I aged was that I was accumulating back fat. And this is a typical thing for middle-aged people to, lose your lean, skin and grow a lot of more, subcutaneous fat and get just kind of thicker all the way around, men and women, women being the worst. And so as a middle-aged woman, I was noticing this change, and I really didn't want this change, and I started to work out more, which was my sort of go-to fix it my whole life. And no matter how much I ran or worked out, it seemed like it wasn't changing the dimensions of this fat on my back. And then I decided that I would shrink the cup back down and say, okay, I'm going to, instead of this many ounces, I'm going to go to this many ounces. And that also didn't do it. And I was almost bargaining with myself. It was like going through the stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining. I was negotiating with myself of how much of this drink I could possibly tolerate and still enjoy it and still not get back fat. But ultimately, I had to admit to myself that the sugar content of my drink was causing back and belly fat, and I had to make a hard choice. And so what I did was I started to make, tea bagged chai at home, add my own milk that was unsweetened, like a plant-based milk, and then add a stevia that made it sweet again. And that has been my new recipe ever since. And the back fat melted off for the most part, and I feel so much more comfortable in my body.
That's a great story. And I think it's helpful for people to know that even if you went to Harvard and even if you're the author of this book, that you have the everyday problems that we all have, including denial and resistance to the change. And then you designed something, reluctantly at first, that eventually worked for you. So what is your bottom line advice to those who feel ready to make significant changes in their lives? How would you summarize, if you possibly could in a minute, what your main point is about the book and how you might be able to motivate people to get started?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're all in the same boat. All of us are trying to get ourselves to do something that we know is better for us, that we know is more healthy or more peaceful for us, and we just can't do it because of the way our brains are engineered to be more efficient and help us be in a routine. So the solution to that for all of us is to think like designers and to approach it with a mindset of design, and that gives us the patience and the endurance to get through the hard stuff, to get through the disappointments, to get through our expectations that were fixed and be more fluid and more successful. That's my hope, is with this book and everything else, that people realize that there is a way out for themselves and that they can be free of these persistent failures through design.
Dr. Kyra Bobinette is a medical doctor, scientist, designer, and strategist with decades of experience as a healthcare expert and consultant. She's also the CEO of Engaged In, a behavior design firm. Her new book is Well Designed Life, 10 Lessons in Brain Science and Design Thinking for a Mindful, Healthy, and Purposeful Life. Thank you so very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.